Lecture 4, John Stuart Mill's Philosophy of Freedom.
John Stuart Mill, an English theorist born in 1806, 36 years after Hegel, is identified with the idea of freedom more than perhaps any philosopher that we might consider because of his classic work, On Liberty. On Liberty was published in 1859 and had managed to define the meaning of freedom with extraordinary clarity and precision. The book is a powerful, a lasting statement. It's logically developed, it's forcefully argued. The conception of freedom that Mill offers in On Liberty is so different from that of Hegel that it's hard to believe that they're writing about the same idea of freedom. Whereas Hegel, as we saw, conceives of God and the state as integral parts of his philosophy of freedom, Mill separates his idea of freedom from both God and the state because he believes that too much of either religion or the state can thwart individual liberty rather than enhance it. Yet, as we'll see, it is not religion or the state that worries Mill most. It's rather the way that society infringes on individual liberty and creates, as Mill uses the term, a tyranny of the majority. Now, this was a problem that Hegel never considered. It was the threat from Mill's point of view of conformity, of a kind of social censorship that oppresses creativity and individuality. That is the threat to human freedom that Mill is most concerned, with which Mill is most concerned. The enemy to liberty in Mill's time was a Victorian code of morality that stifled both men and women in their attempts at free expression of thought or behavior. And Mill's passion when he considers this enemy to freedom is so great that we must, before we turn to On Liberty, I think try to understand the depth of John Stuart Mill's purpose by asking first, why was the book written? Mill describes in his autobiography his extraordinary childhood, an upbringing that was determined by his father, James Mill, a person who seemed convinced that he had discovered the truth in the theory of the British philosopher Jeremy Bentham. And while this might not have been so bad in itself, he then determined to create out of his young son a perfect disciple of Jeremy Bentham, with the mission of carrying Bentham's message to the whole world. Mill describes the process that ensued, a process of harsh indoctrination that was an appalling success. That is, Mill did become a prodigy, able to expound the philosophy of Jeremy Bentham, but at a terrible cost to his own emotional being. Mill relates this in his autobiography, that is, the experience of a childhood and being raised by a father who was determined to create out of him a disciple. Mill says, "I began to learn Greek when I was 3 years old, but I learnt no Latin until my 8th year. At that time I read, under my father's tuition, a number of Greek prose authors, among whom I remember the whole of Herodotus, the first 6 dialogues of Plato, from the Euthyphron to the Theaetetus inclusive, the last dialogue, totally impossible for me to understand. But my father, in all his teaching, demanded of me not only the utmost that I could do, but much that I could by no possibility have ever done. What he was himself willing to undergo for the sake of my instruction may be judged from the fact that I went through the whole process of preparing my Greek lessons in the same room and at the same table at which he was writing. And as in those days, Greek and English lexicons were not, I was forced to have recourse to him for the meaning of every word that I didn't know. This incessant interruption, he, one of the most impatient of men, submitted to in the cause of my education. From about the age of 12, I entered into another and more advanced stage in my course of instruction. This commenced with logic. My father made me read whole or parts of several of the Latin treatises on the scholastic logic, giving each day to him in our walks a minute account of what I had read and answering his numerous and his searching questions. From his own intercourse with me, I could derive none but a very humble opinion of myself, and the standard of comparison he always held up to me was not what other people did, but what a man could and ought to do. If I thought anything about myself, it was that I was rather backward in my studies, since I always found myself so in comparison with what my father expected from me. He wound up by saying that whatever I knew more than others could not be ascribed to any merit in me, but to the very unusual advantage which had fallen to my lot of having a father who was able to teach me and willing to give the necessary trouble and time. That it was no matter of praise to me if I knew more than those who had not had a similar advantage, but the deepest disgrace to me if I did not. Well, that's the story of the early education, and it is as Mill described it, believe it or not, and that is his father, James Mill, an historian writer in his own right, insisted that he would have total control over his son's education, and John Stuart Mill never attended a school. He received his entire instruction from his father, and he emerged in his teens as one of the leaders in British intellectual circles, publishing articles at age 15 and 16 that one would identify with a learned, erudite person at age 30 or 40. An extraordinary success, but we perhaps don't need Freud to tell us this, at a tremendous cost to his, as I said, psychological well-being. So he describes the emotional breakdown that ensues. From when I first read Bentham, I had what might truly be called one object in life, to be a reformer of the world. My conception of my own happiness was entirely identified with this object. But the time came when I awakened from this as from a dream. It was in the autumn of 1826. I was in a wretched state of nerves, unsusceptible to any enjoyment. In this frame of mind, it occurred to me to put the question directly to myself. Suppose that all your objects in life were realized, that all the changes in institutions and opinions which you are looking forward to could be completely effected at this very instant. Would this be a great joy and happiness to you? An irrepressible self-consciousness directly answered, no. At this, my heart sank within me. The whole foundation on which my life was constructed fell apart. All my happiness was to have been found in the continual pursuit of this end. The end had ceased to charm, and how could there ever again be any interest in the means? I seemed to have nothing left to live for. I sought no comfort by speaking to others of what I felt. If I had loved anyone sufficiently to make confiding my griefs a necessity, I should not have been in the condition I was. My father, to whom it would have been natural to me to have had recourse in any practical difficulties, was the last person to whom, in a case such as this, I looked for help. Everything convinced me that he had no knowledge of any mental state as I was suffering from, and that even if he could be made to understand that he was not the physician who could heal it. My education, who was wholly his work, had been conducted without any regard to the possibility of its ending in this result. And I saw no use in giving him the pain of thinking that his plans had failed, when the failure was probably irremediable, and at all events beyond the power of his remedies. Of other friends, I had at that time none to whom I had any hope of making my condition intelligible. It was, however, abundantly intelligible to myself, and the more I dwelt upon it, the more hopeless it appeared. And Mill describes how the gloom and the depression becomes greater, and he is unable to shake it. At age 20, 21, 22, he moves through his studies then as a robot, unable to contend with the mental state, the depression that swept over him. And then he manages to snap out of it. And it's a result of a particular friendship that he forms. And he describes it. It was at the period of my mental progress, which I have just described, that I finally formed the friendship which was to have the honor and chief blessing of my existence, as well as the source of a great part of all that I have attempted to do or hope to effect hereafter for human improvement. My first introduction to the lady who, after a friendship of 20 years, consented to be my wife was in 1830, when I was in my 25th and she in her 23rd year. Although it was years after my introduction to Mrs. Harriet Taylor, before my acquaintance with her became at all intimate or confidential, I very soon felt her to be the most admirable person I had ever known. Now, Mill does not mention here that when he first met Harriet Taylor in July of 1830, she had been married to her husband, John Taylor, for 4 years, and had by him two children, ages 3 and 6 months. She had her third and last child in 1831. Shortly after their first meeting, they began an intimate and a lasting friendship. Harriet Taylor's husband died in 1849, and 2 years later they were married. From Mill's perspective, his relationship with Harriet Taylor not only inspired many of the ideas in On Liberty, but also in his original work, The Subjection of Women. In personal terms, her friendship rescued him from the depression that he described in his autobiography. But their relationship had mixed results. The openness of their relationship, although tolerated by her husband for almost 20 years, brought down on them the wrath of Victorian society. The strict moral codes of their time became oppressive for them, and it's this that Mill refers to when he condemns the tyranny of the majority in On Liberty. As a result of this experience, Mill rejected the uniformity and the conformity preached by any strict code of social conduct, whether taught by a church or by a Benthamite. He became instead a champion of diversity and of versatility, and above all, of an individual's freedom of choice. So in his autobiography, when he explains the main purpose of writing On Liberty, he relates that the book attempted to show, he says, the importance to man and society of a large variety in types of character and of giving full freedom to human nature to expand itself in innumerable and conflicting directions, lest society should impose on mankind an oppressive yoke of uniformity in opinion and practice. When we turn to the inscription of On Liberty, it's no surprise that Mill dedicates it to Harriet Taylor in the most effusive terms, as the inspiration of all that's the best in his writings, a person of, he says, unrivaled wisdom. So let's look at how Mill develops his theory of freedom in On Liberty. And after tracing that argument, see how it applies to our own thinking about freedom today in America, keeping in mind all the time that this was the main purpose behind his book, to champion the idea of diversity in society, to oppose moral codes of morality, codes of morality that would, in the strict way that he so abhorred, deprive an individual of their own spheres, of his or her own sphere of privacy. In the opening sentence of On Liberty, Mill announces that the subject of the book is civil and social liberty, or, he says, the nature and limits of the power which can be legitimately exercised by society over the individual. And this is indeed the main theme that Mill consistently follows throughout the book. Almost like a physician, he sees and diagnoses a problem and then prescribes a remedy for it. He begins by describing the social problem of his era and then prescribes a way of treating it. That is, the problem is the attempt by society to make individuals conform to a code of behavior, no matter how irrational or silly that code may be, and the solution is to preserve and then enlarge the realm of individual freedom. Mill sets up the logic of the problem and its solution in the introduction to On Liberty. He says, "The tyranny of the majority means that when society, as opposed to just the state, is itself the tyrant, when it issues mandates in things with which it ought not to meddle, then it practices a social tyranny more formidable than political oppression, because it leaves fewer means of escape, penetrating much more deeply into the details of life and enslaving the soul itself. Protection, therefore, against the tyranny of the magistrate is not enough. There needs protection against the tyranny of the prevailing opinion and feeling, against the tendency of society to impose by other means than civil liberties its own ideas and practices as rules of conduct on those who dissent from them, to fetter the development and, if possible, prevent the formation of any individuality not in harmony with its own ways, and compels all characters to fashion themselves upon the model of its own. There's a limit to the legitimate interference of collective opinion with individual independence, and to find that limit and maintain it against encroachment is as indispensable to a good condition of human affairs as protection against political despotism." Now, that opening statement, a powerful one, the indictment of the tyranny of the majority, and again, we want to examine it as closely as we can. When he talks about the tyranny of the majority as opposed to just the state, he's signaling his own view of freedom. Previously, English theorists like Locke had stressed the need for political freedom. Mill is now insisting that the sphere of political freedom must be expanded to include social freedom, that is, the right of the individual to resist codes of moral behavior or the will of society to set up as an idol the ideal of conformity. When he says that when society is itself the tyrant by issuing mandates, controlling human behavior and practicing a social tyranny, enslaving the soul itself, he is setting forth an indictment that's severe, but a true one. I remember when I was lecturing on this several years ago, and a student in my class said afterwards that he had appreciated what I was saying, but not fully until an experience that he had soon after the lecture. He said that he was gay, but had trouble coming out of the closet, as we say, and confiding, even to his closest friends, his homosexuality. He was walking in Greenwich Village with a friend, close friend, and they passed a group of gays coming towards them, and the friend turned to him and said, "I hate these queers. I wish that AIDS would get all of them." And Danny said that his guts just went into a wrench, and unable to break the silence that he knew he should, he kept walking and hated himself for it. He said that he kept thinking of those lines from Mill's On Liberty about the tyranny of the majority and the way in which it enslaves the soul itself, setting forth a kind of behavior that is so difficult to break, so difficult to challenge. And it was at that moment, he said, that Mill became real to him. Now, Mill says that we have to set up a protection against this kind of invasiveness. And think of the contrast here between Mill and Hegel. Mill is entering a whole realm of freedom now that is so different from what Hegel had spoken of. Mill says that the protection must be made on the basis of a principle. And that principle must establish a limit to the legitimate interference of collective opinion with individual independence. So the purpose of the book now, after having indicated the problem, is to turn to the solution. And the solution is to determine that principle that will establish the limit. It is that that Mill now decides that he must do. By finding, by maintaining a limit on social interference, Mill means that he wants to establish a principle that will maintain the sanctity of individual free expression. Later in the introduction, he asserts this principle, and it is that the only justification which any society has for restricting social freedom, or for restricting individual freedom, is if the individual clearly threatens harm to society. Now, what does this mean? It means that society is not justified in enforcing a code of morality or social behavior because they feel that the individual will harm himself or herself, as, for example, say, drinking alcohol or smoking cigarettes, or to prohibit deviant sexual behavior that does not harm others, or religious belief or offensive speech or dress, again, so long as it does not actually inflict harm on others. Now, this principle must apply to the protection of individual liberty in the broadest sense, and Mill lists all the particular freedoms that he wants ensured. That is, freedom of thought, freedom of feeling, freedom of opinion, freedom of conscience on all subjects, and the freedom to publish these ideas. Freedom of the most eccentric tastes, preferences. Freedom to plan our own lives as we deem desirable, even though this may seem foolish or self-destructive to others. Freedom of assembly, of petition, all the other civil liberties that are listed in our own Bill of Rights. Because freedom means, Mill says, in his own words, to pursue our own good in our own way, so long as we do not deprive others of their freedom or harm their efforts. Now, Mill repeatedly says that the only justification for restricting liberty or punishing a person for wrong behavior is if it causes harm to society. But what exactly does Mill mean by doing harm? What sort of conduct, we can ask Mill, must be deemed harmful? Mill says that, again to quote from Liberty, no person ought to be punished simply for being drunk, because that in itself is not doing social harm. But a soldier or a policeman should be punished for being drunk on duty. Or we might say, alcoholism itself shouldn't be punished. But driving a car while under the influence of alcohol certainly should be. Sometimes the lines are extraordinarily difficult to draw between behavior that is harmful and behavior that is just a nuisance, not substantially harmful to society. And I recall several years ago, before I moved into Manhattan and commuted regularly to New Jersey and then back to where I teach at Barnard in New York, spent a lot of time on the bus commuting back and forth. And one time when I was preparing my Mill lecture on the bus, reading On Liberty, I noticed something that helped me understand, perhaps, how I could get the idea across better to my students. I noticed that as I was sitting on the bus, the man next to me was picking his nose and relishing it. And as I sort of watched in fascination this, I began to think, well, what would Mill say about that? And then just as I was wrapped in that thought, a woman sitting across the aisle lit up a cigarette. And she was smoking merrily away, even though no smoking signs all over on the bus. And I thought to myself, well, what would Mill think of that? So I came to the conclusion that I could speak to the woman and ask her to put out the cigarette, because with all of the evidence that we have about side stream smoke, et cetera, also because it was against the law to smoke on the bus, it was legitimate for me to, on million grounds, to suggest that she was perhaps doing harm to society by smoking. If she had been smoking by herself, out of range, side stream smoke, etc., then it would have been more difficult for me to make that claim, although, of course, those of us who are opposed to cigarette smoking can make the claim that it raises our insurance rates, all society, etc. But in this case, we're speaking only of how far her smoking on that bus tended to jeopardize my health, and I felt that I could speak to her. I felt that I couldn't speak to the guy next to me picking his nose, because no matter how much watching a person pick his nose vigorously might make one ill and bring on physical harm in that sense, it's too much to try to enforce that degree of social behavior. And we have friends coming from the far corners of the country to New York City, and we take them on tours of Greenwich Village, our favorite place in Manhattan. And there are friends who object vigorously to the green hair or the blue hair of people walking around St. Mark's. That kind of objection, which they insist makes them ill, they're so revulsed by that kind of behavior among our young people, that, again, impossible to enforce. We cannot sweep through Greenwich Village and insist that all people have their hair worn in a certain way or a certain color. Where are the lines, then, as we try to draw them between what is harmful and not harmful? Part of it is what is enforceable and not enforceable. But Mill's point is this, that we must try to build evidence before we restrict someone's behavior, that that behavior is actually inflicting physical harm on others. Whether or not the definition should encompass mental harm, psychological harm, that we'll be coming to in a moment when we consider the application of Mill's principles to Supreme Court decisions in the United States in cases that come up there. But for the present, we're concerned with this, and that is in our everyday personal behavior, what do we say about the freedom of another individual as we move through life? This is not Hegelian. This is very practical. This is a question of how we behave sitting next to an individual on a bus or walking through the villages, walking through the streets of Greenwich Village. We may have one sexual preference or another. This is very personal. And Mill meant it to be personal because he had suffered as a person so much at the hands of a kind of morality, a restrictive behavior that, from his point of view, undermined the very bases of liberty in a free society. I think that when we look at Mill's argument, we must be impressed with the systematic nature of what he's trying to set forth. He's concerned, as we must be concerned, over the core issue of freedom, as freedom is related to moral values. And the core issue for Mill as a philosopher is especially the free expression of ideas and opinions. Most of On Liberty is concerned with how to protect and enlarge this kind of freedom, that is, freedom of opinion, freedom of ideas. And Mill states his case, I think, eloquently on this point. In one of the more renowned passages in On Liberty, he says this: if all mankind minus one were of one opinion, and only one person were of the contrary opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he, if he had the power, would be justified in silencing mankind. I must say, if only Hegel would have written with that clarity, we could applaud perhaps his philosophy more than we do. Not to downplay Hegel's influence, particularly in terms of nationalism and the freedom of the nation state, but Mill is speaking here a language, maybe it's the bright and glorious language of English philosophy, but nevertheless, it's a language that we can grasp, understand. And he's speaking here of the sanctity of individual free expression. And he makes now an absolute and unyielding case in terms of his argument for freedom of opinion and freedom of ideas. Were an opinion, he continues in the same passage, a personal possession of no value except to the owner, if to be obstructed in the enjoyment of it were simply a private injury, it would make some difference whether the injury was inflicted only on a few persons or on many. But the peculiar evil of silencing the expression of an opinion is that it's robbing the human race, posterity as well as the existing generation, those who dissent from the opinion still more than those who hold it. If the opinion is right, they are deprived of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. If wrong, they lose what is almost as great a benefit, the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth produced by its collision with error. And we'll be coming back to several of these points as we move along, particularly Mill's concept of truth emerging as a result of conflict between truth and error. But note the way in which in this passage he values ideas. As he says, if an idea were merely a personal possession or property of no value, then that would be one thing to suppress it. But it's not. An idea is a value for all of society. An idea can, from Mill's point of view, oppose the worst excesses or falsehoods or whatever and overturn them in time. And when he enunciates that belief in the power of ideas, I think he speaks to the heart of our own culture, the point that I was making at the very outset, and that is the idea of freedom is, for Mill, a vigorous concept that is alive and that will spread if we will only give it the chance. So Mill takes off from this point to make an extended defense of free expression, and especially the right to dissent. The argument that he makes is a careful one, and it deserves close attention. Mill says that we may imagine three cases where the question of suppressing a dissenting opinion might arise. First, if the dissenting opinion is true, as, for example, the opinions of Socrates or Copernicus or Galileo when they were first advanced. And in this case, Mill says, it's obviously wrong to suppress a true opinion, so there can be no justification for that. The second case is much more difficult to decide. And this is when the dissenting opinion is false, as, for example, in a community that enjoys social tolerance, bigots emerge to preach anti-Semitism. Mill's position here is what we shall see in a moment was reiterated in America by the Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, and the position is that falsehood must be exposed to public view and subjected to debate because suppression can only feed it, and the truer opinion then becomes dead dogma, unchallenged, and ignored. And then there's the third case, which Mill says is the most frequent one. Remember the three cases. One is the dissenting opinion is clearly true, and the dissenting opinion is false. The third case is more common, and that is when there are several conflicting opinions, and no one is entirely true or false, the truth is distributed among them. Or as Mill writes, one part of the truth sets while another rises. In this case, Mill says, it's essential to maintain free expression because as society learns to tell truth from error, by continually being subjected to a clash of ideas, not one monotone of public opinion. Mills states his view of truth clearly when he says that truth is so much a question of the reconciling and the combining of opposites that its determination has to be made by the rough process of a struggle between combatants fighting under hostile banners. This statement is a suggestion of one way that he is like Hegel, and that is he does, in characteristic Western form, he does sanction conflict, and from conflict we will move into a state of progress. The conflict, of course, has to be politicized. He is not for violent conflict, in any case, as Hegel was for violent conflict, that is, a clash between states. The conflict is among ideas. And Mill says the truth can only emerge if there is a genuine conflict. And note the strength with which he states this, and that is, truth is so much a question of reconciling and combining of opposites, determination has to be made by the rough process of a struggle between combatants fighting under hostile banners. So that kind of contest is essential in order for truth to emerge. Now, Mill's view of truth is unlike Hegel's view of truth. I characterize Hegel's view of truth as truth-possessed, to use a phrase that applies to a number of political theorists. Mill's view of truth I characterize as truth-pursued rather than truth-possessed. And that is, we are in a process, a liberal process of struggling for greater and greater truth. Mill himself obviously wouldn't have claimed to possess any truth at that particular time, any final and ultimate truth, because truth must evolve. And it must evolve, note, as a result of this rough process. There must be, then, parties on one hand arguing with parties on the other, in the way, if you've watched British parliamentary proceedings, there so often is. Truth possessed, then, versus truth pursued. It's striking how political theory can be divided into groups. On the one hand, that argue the truth possessed, when they speak about truth, and Hegel is the quintessential expression here, as truth being God and having known it, and then the other group, headed especially by the liberals, begun with Locke, but now in archetypal form expressed by Mill in the beginning of the 19th century. This is English liberalism at its best. The liberals look for truth in the process. Some may complain that there is never an end. That is, that they look only to the means and never the end. But Mill defends that, arguing that the best we can do is to maintain a healthy process in which there is an exchange, a true exchange of ideas. So Mill's theory of liberty is that free expression of ideas and opinions must be preserved as a kind of sacred task in all cases. And so this is an absolute defense of free thought as long as it does not inflict harm on others. He asserts a belief in the value of ideas for any society, but ideas that remain in continuing conflict, in a state of competition. That is what he likes to call a free marketplace of ideas. So that's the essence of On Liberty. And he makes this case, citing historical examples, arguing for the defense of freedom in this way, a case, it seems to me, that is directly opposed not only to Hegel, certainly is, but also to Rousseau. We have Mill never insisting on equality, by the way, as Rousseau did, but always insisting that the growth of equality may threaten or thwart the growth of liberty. So he's not concerned about creating, as Locke was not concerned, a classless society. That's not his task. He's not in any way a socialist and not subscribing to the goal of egalitarianism that Rousseau did. So there will be as sharp a contrast between Mill and Hegel as there was between Mill and Marx. Marx being another truth-possessed figure who believes that the truth shall set us free, but Marx knowing what the truth was. and willing to free or emancipate people on the basis of their acquisition of that truth. From Mill's point of view, he is not setting forth the truth, the final truth, as Marx and Hegel did. He is setting forth only the process. Now, keeping in mind that as the essential argument in liberty, let's turn to the defense of civil liberties in the United States, because that, it seems to me, is a clear expression of what Mill was about. And let's look at a couple of landmark Supreme Court decisions, especially to that set forth by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, a Millian to the core, was a Supreme Court justice, as you know, in the United States from 1902 to 1932. And in one of his opinions, in Skenk versus the United States, he expressed a judgment that was relevant to our study of Mill. Skenk was a member of the Socialist Party. He was convicted of distributing subversive literature to men awaiting induction to the United States Armed Forces for World War I. Holmes and the court viewed this in a majority decision as a threat to the nation during wartime, ruling that, quote, the character of every act depends on the circumstances in which it is done. The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. That's giving us one of the famous images from Supreme Court judgments, and that is, your right to free speech is not protected if in a crowded theater you suddenly get the idea, hey, I'll cry fire and see what happens and stir up some activity. That is not permissible. The question in every case, Holmes says, is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger. When a nation is at war, many things that might be said in times of peace are such a hindrance to its effort that their utterance will not be endured so long as men fight and no court could regard them as protected by any constitutional right. But only 8 months later, in another case, Abrams versus the United States, Holmes wrote in a dissenting opinion now, a powerful defense of free speech. Abrams was a Russian anarchist convicted of distributing leaflets that condemned the U.S. for sending troops into Russia following the Bolshevik Revolution. Holmes could not view this as a clear and present danger to the United States. Of course, the war is over now. He wrote, when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, they may come to believe even more than they believe the very foundations of their own conduct, that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, that the best test of truth is the power of thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market, and that truth is the only ground upon which their wishes can be safely carried out. That, at any rate, is the theory of our Constitution. We should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death, unless they are so imminently a threat to immediate interference with the lawful and pressing purposes of the law that an immediate check is required to save the country. 10 years later, in another court decision, Holmes once again defended free speech, saying, if there is any principle of the Constitution that more imperatively calls for attachment than any other, it is the principle of free thought, not free thought for who agree with us, but freedom of thought for the thought that we hate. Freedom of thought for the thought that we hate. Holmes summarizes Mill's position then clearly. Now, the question from Holmes's point of view is whether or not there is a clear and present danger to the safety, the security of the nation or society. If that can be established, fine. Then free speech may be restricted. But if it cannot, then we defend freedom of thought for the thought that we hate. Now, one famous case of this occurred in the Skokie instance, where in Skokie, Illinois, Frank Cullen, head of the U.S. Nazi Party, asked to hold a rally. Every attempt was made to suppress him, and Cullen took his case to court. In that case, several Jewish groups of Skokie claimed that a Nazi demonstration constituted menticide or infliction of mental harm. The decision never got to the Supreme Court, but the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit of Illinois ruled for Colin on the basis of First Amendment freedom and said this: above all else, the First Amendment means that government has no power to restrict expression because of its message, its ideas, its subject matter, or its content. To assure self-fulfillment for each individual, our people are guaranteed the right to express any thought free from government censorship. Under the First Amendment, there is no such thing as a false idea. On the competition of other ideas, every person must be his own watchman for truth, because the forefathers did not trust any government to separate for us the true from the false. That comes in the process. Well, I think this is how Mill's idea of freedom applies to the United States, as interpreted by our highest courts, or especially by Holmes. Mill's defense of liberty insisted on a marketplace of free exchange of ideas. In order to maintain the freedom of this exchange, we must allow for competition among all elements, those that we like and those that we dislike. True ideas, if we can call them that, exist to be challenged. Hateful ideas exist to keep the conflict alive, or else we'll all fall into an intellectual stupor. And as we slumber, the worst ideas may take over because we have not been inoculated to protect ourselves from the virus. The virus of, say, Nazism by exposure in smaller doses. And so we defend freedom for the thought that we hate.